Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Welcome to One Sweet Dream, a podcast where we explore the dream that was and is the Beatles.
Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Tiana.
How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thank you.
So who are we talking with today?
I am talking to Joshua Wolf Schenk, who is the author of The Powers of Two.
And why did you want to talk with Joshua?
Well, I really like the concept of his book. You know, he dug into the magic and chemistry of creative partnerships. He challenges the lone genius concept. Instead, he proposes that people who accomplish great things in society often have a partner or a collaborator in some form or another. And obviously, this is highly relevant to the Beatles story, given the primacy and importance of the Lennon-McCartney partnership, right? Mm-hmm. He has interviewed apparently over 100 creative partnerships and found that there were a lot of similarities about successful partnerships. And there seemed to be a lot of tenets or ingredients necessary. So we can sort of see, you know, how Lennon and McCartney fit into these. But also, he uses Lennon and McCartney as a lead partnership because he said that they exemplified great creative partnerships in so many ways, in both the good and the bad.
I love this. I can't wait to dig in.
Yeah. Sometimes it's hard to understand Lennon-McCartney because this area has been so underinvestigated. You know, like they have a relationship that not that many of us understand. Mm-hmm. And he gives us an insight into what happens when you're inside of these so that we sort of have a greater understanding of the upsides and downsides of partnerships. You know, most of us don't understand what it's like to create with a person. And so he gives us a peek into what goes on in these kinds of relationships and the emotions that they have.
So do you like his take on Lennon and McCartney?
Well, here's the thing about his point of view is that he understands Lennon more as a creative person. He's dug into Lennon's work more deeply than McCartney. So I like his understanding of how creative partnerships work. What I didn't always agree with is his take on Lennon and McCartney, because I think he tended to fall into some of the surface level readings of Lennon McCartney because he really gets Lennon, and his reading of McCartney sort of leans on some of the tropes. And I think McCartney is a much more complicated person. I think his role with Lennon is much more complicated. So I push back on some of his takes on them as a creative partnership. And he and I have had a few conversations, and we've had some fun kind of debating these. Because he was talking to 100 partnerships, he can't go as deeply. But I do think that his view on how creative relationships work is really worth talking about. So this is why I wanted to talk to him.
Well, I can't wait to hear about it.
Let's jump in.
Hello, T.
Today, I have the absolute pleasure of speaking to Joshua Wolf-Shank, the author of The Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. I am so excited to speak to you, Joshua. So thank you for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Although over the years, I've read a million books about the Beatles and really have spent a lot of time diving into their narrative, there was always a sense that their story didn't totally make sense to me. And it was only when I read your article in The Atlantic, and then I read your book, that I really re-engaged, because it was like the first time that I thought, yeah, okay, now this is starting to make more sense to me. And, you know, there's a quote by Cynthia Lennon, and I'm paraphrasing here, but she says that so many authors get the story factually right, but emotionally wrong.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things that I've noticed in Beatles books is that it's like a litany of things they did. And, you know, it's kind of like what the four of them were doing and, you know, different things that happened in their life. But weirdly, the relationship between Lennon and McCartney is so rarely explored.
Yeah.
It's shocking to me. And it's interesting because our longest running series is about the breakup, and we go deep into their relationship and partnership to explore the dynamics of it. And, you know, there was a blogger who actually commented on it. He said, it's weird to think that this nobody has done this. I mean, it's such an integral and core element to the Beatles' success, and yet it goes unexplored.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of core challenges. One is just simple. I mean, the fancy word for it is historiography. Like, what is the material that we use to tell a story from the past? And, you know, the best historians get down to the primary evidence, but the primary evidence here is really, really problematic, because the basic material, you know, the basic tracks were laid down in the late 60s and early 70s. Up to that point, there wasn't a lot of insight into the relationship, and there was very little testimony from either side. And we can return to this, but this is extremely common with deeply connected creative partners, that part of what they do is, I call it closing the door in the book, that they remove themselves from inspection, inquiry, and that is actually an essential part of the bond. And often there are kind of explicit agreements that go along with that. In the case of Lennon McCartney, it was the joint crediting. Dave Chappelle and Neil Brennan, who created Chappelle's Show, agreed very early on that they would not discuss or reveal who did what. And those are very similar. And Lennon McCartney basically abided by that. There are a couple of exceptions. The Hunter Davies insight into their process is an essential text. But basically, you know, they were guys who, you know, they did what they did. They brought it to the band. The band brought it to the public. And they were not interrogating their relationship for outsiders until the relationship began to go, until it got really troubled. And those troubles became public necessarily because they were huge stars, because there was legal action involved. And that's the moment when they begin narrating their experience. And at that time, they each had, in my view, a kind of psychological crisis, because their whole creative presence in the world, their identity, everything that they had was wrapped up in this partnership. And they actually had very little of what, you know, you would consider like a kind of creative ego that was intact and had integrity. I mean, now we take for granted all the track notes and all the stuff you find online. And people had no idea who did what about the way the work had been made, except for that it was credited to these two people, this joint entity called Lennon McCartney. And so now suddenly they're kind of, and they're still extremely young, they're in their 20s, for God's sake. The metaphor I use in the book may be pedestrian, but, you know, I think it holds up in my mind, is that it's as though your whole life, you have a joint banking account, and every bit of capital you have gets contributed to it. And then suddenly you find yourself with needs, and you can't draw on that joint account anymore. What do you do? It's a crisis, and that's the kind of creative crisis they had. You know, Lennon, Paul, as much you know, McCartney is much more diplomatic and consistent. Lennon was much more kind of would go from one extreme to the other.
Yeah.
Created a really problematic primary record. And that, I think, is the beginning of the problem in telling the true story of the partnership. And then the second problem is just that it's emotionally, psychologically, and narratively challenging to talk about what passes between two people. And most people don't want to do that work. And they don't want to kind of come from the place of humility. They don't want to acknowledge all that's not known. They want concrete action, bodies in space, simple heroes, and enemies. And so it is kind of outrageous that the story hasn't been told right, but it's also totally understandable given, you know, how impoverished we are as a culture in assessing creative exchange.
Right. One of the reasons why we started talking about the breakup was because we thought so many of the myths of Lennon and McCartney stem from the breakup and the breakup narrative.
Yeah.
That especially the first
breakup,
few years,
so-called.
Well, yes, I agree. The so-called breakup, which I totally agree with.
It's really, I wouldn't join on, you know, the Beatle nerds that we're in a virtual conversation with now. To use a different word, an interruption, a hiatus, separation.
You know,
it was not a divorce. No one ever intended to be a divorce. The inflammatory language, you don't even need to go that deep to see that there was a kind of pleasure on both sides that what I talk about in the book is as adversarial collaboration, which often happens between overt opponents like sports rivals, but often that same dynamic happens inside creative partnership. And that was, those guys were driven from that from the very first moment, they set eyes on each other, but the first moment there was any kind of real interaction, it was like, hey, I can do this. And then the other one was goaded to do better. He was aroused, and it was a combination of excitement and warmth and identification, and also this kind of wonderful competitive drive. And they did that, and you know, they made magic through that energy. And now you find yourself at a time when they're not recording together, but they're continuing to do that. They're responding to each other. They're trying to one up each other. They have a constant eye on the other, and
they're writing songs to each other. Like they have a dialogue going on in song still in the 70s.
A dialogue in songs, and also, yeah, dialogue, saw each other and on and on. And, you know, the thing I would love to know more about, if we're going to get into the history, is that there's this period, this crucial period where Lennon and Ono are separated. And the intimacy between Lennon and McCartney is heightening. And there's a moment when they have a plan to get in the studio. And that all seems really, from my read of the sources, like super solid. Like, yeah, it was happening.
Yep.
And then it didn't happen. And what was going on then? And at some point, a great deal more material will arise. And I think that is a really, really key moment to understand. And then, of course, people who are deep into this know, well, you know, what was going on around, you know, just before Lennon was shot, that he was emerging from a kind of isolation to engage creatively in a variety of ways, including with the band. He wanted to get back in the studio with the band.
Okay, so can we just take a step back and go back to the importance of creative pairs and then jump back into our conversation about Lennon McCartney?
Well, in general, relationships as a force for creativity is drastically underappreciated. The Lone Genius is a really convenient story for journalists, for historians, for critics. And it's very popular with audiences who very often want to have an attachment to a single individual and not feel like they're looking onto a relationship that
they could never actually be inside of. I appreciate that you feel that the book is insightful. It probably does come from looking closely at Lennon and McCartney, but alongside, you know, hundreds of other really meaningful creative pairings,
yeah,
you know, throughout history from across all fields, and looking for, you know, what are the themes show up over and over again. Some of the partnerships that I investigate are extremely well known. Many of them, you know, you wouldn't even know that there was a partnership. I think a lot these days about Ralph Abernathy, who is, yeah, that's just a name that very few people in the world could even identify. But he was from the very beginning of Martin Luther King's career as an activist, was by his side to the very end. And, you know, very often core relationships look like, you know, they actually look like adversarial relationships, but they end up being quite primary. So that's the perspective I brought to the Beatles and to Lennon McCartney. And what I found is they really light up and exemplify these themes that I found to be true across all times and all situations. And I think it does reveal a lot of the kind of basic truth of how they created and the great work they made. It shines a light on a lot of the questions that we're still really holding with a, you know, a great deal of curiosity. The word collaboration is often used, but what I'm talking about is much broader than collaboration. I'm talking about places where two people are affecting each other in a way that makes the work greater. And a lot of the project of the book is to look at all the different ways that happens.
Yeah.
You know, I talk about Larry Bird and Magic Johnson and the way that they were so organized to beat each other, but they ended up creating each other. This,
yeah,
this phrase adversarial collaboration applies. That also to some extent, that dynamic also to some extent applies to Lennon and McCartney.
Yep.
So many of the core qualities show up with their relationship.
I think I mentioned this to you before, but there's a historiographer, her name is Erin Torkelson Weber, and she says that the two main debates, the two great debates in Beatledom are who is the greater genius between Lennon and McCartney,
right,
and, you know, who was responsible for the breakup. And, you know, I think that both of those are incorrect, you know, discussions or debates, because I don't really think that either of them was responsible or that they really ever broke up. And certainly, you know, based on what you're talking about and what I totally believe is that it's impossible to separate and claim that one is the greater genius because of this. Well, it's the equation that you talk about, the one plus one equals
infinity is the way I describe it.
Yeah. Yes.
Two,
yes.
Two exactly. People unleash something in each other. And really, I think with John and Paul, you could say that they so decisively interacted with one another that in a way they really created each other. Of course, they are individuals, but they also were so entwined. And we're learning from social science that this is just the way the human brain actually works. We're so deeply relational that you could look at us as individuals, and that, of course, is valid. But it's also, you could look at us like aspen trees, that we're ostensibly discrete and separate, but actually so bound up in one another and so affecting one another that we're really like part of the same organism.
Right. And that they were. I mean, and that's why I think so many of the biographies or the, you know, the group biographies of the Beatles don't make sense when you don't talk about the interconnectedness of them.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and when they think that the Beatles just broke up in 1970, you know, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But I'd love to start at the beginning of your, just talk about some of the tenets or some of the themes that you saw with great creative partnerships. Now, first of all, you talk about the dyad or the pair as this primary creative unit. Why is the pair so much more powerful than any other kind of configuration when it comes to creativity.
Yeah, there are a couple things. While really important things happen in triads and in, you know, groups of four and more, and all of these social units are really very meaningful. You know, there are collectives and there's scenes. My friend Austin Kleon is a big fan of this term, the scenius, as opposed to genius. You know, that the most meaningful work happens, you know, in culture. But it is also often the case that, you know, two people end up pairing up sort of away from a crowd, and that a lot of the most startling creative advances happens, you know, in that dyadic relationship. And I think it relates to what actually happens in the human mind when we're being most creative. If you really slow down and pay attention to yourself in moments of insight or advance, there is a kind of internal conversation. And a lot of what it means to be creative is to try to reduce this noise of, you know, dozens or, you know, or maybe more kind of voices and inputs, and actually hear, well, hey, how about it? How about this? Well, that's interesting. Well, what about this? When your mind is able to do that, that's when we're being most creative. And I think there's something going on that I explore in the book between two physical individuals relating and this kind of internal process in the mind. But you know, I'm not so much. Creativity happens, and when you are physically alone, so much creativity happens in a group setting. You know, a band on stage is obviously a very important creative unit. So I'm not discounting those things, and I'm not saying, oh my God, unless there are two people sitting across the table from one another, I'm not going to consider it. No, I just think it's a really useful lens on the creative process.
Right. You say in your book that pairs naturally arouse engagement and even intensity. And I guess that there is some kind of intimacy that allows, you know, we'll talk about that something about that unit allows, like the trust and the intimacy allows maybe ideas to grow.
Yeah, there's also a great deal of instability can be organic in a pair because if you think about dynamics with three or more people, things tend to become fixed and hardened. People take roles, whereas two people can play off back and forth. You know, if you think of two people, you're in a room together, there's just the two of you, and one of you, you know, gets up to go get some water. Well, now you've moved to solitude, and then there can be a return to kind of intimacy. And that has happened totally organically. You haven't had to say, oh, well, let's take a break. And, you know, the image I often thought about is that there are two legs to walk and there are three legs for a stool. And two is more fluid and more malleable. What you always find in these really advanced creative relationships is that there's a relationship between the two individuals, but there's also a relationship between that pair and others.
Yes.
Obviously the case with Lennon and McCartney.
Right. Well, you call it the dyad, a special consecration, which is interesting. I mean, you know, married couples are two people. And so there is something special about just the duo. Yeah. That there's a level of intimacy. You know, what's interesting is Peter Asher said that he was watching the Beatles, and he said that he noticed that even when they were performing, Lennon and McCartney acted as a duo, as you know, that they were a pair within the performance because they harmonized so closely. And so I just found that interesting that, you know, Lennon and McCartney as a songwriting partnership is one thing, but they sort of operated like that in whatever environment they were in, you know?
That's cool.
Yeah. So just taking from your book, you said that you had studied hundreds of creative pairs and you found that they moved through roughly six stages and, you know, they followed many of the same patterns or themes. First one is the meeting, you know, and you talk about the conditions and characteristics that engender this chemistry or electricity. Hmm. Confluence, the idea of truly becoming a pair, what that involves. The dialectics, which is really about the enmeshed roles. And distance, the fact that there is an optimal distance or the need for some space in order to give the partnership some ongoing, I guess, tension or spark. This idea of the infinite game, this idea of the pair is operated at the nexus of competition and cooperation, and interruption that often they are driven apart by the same energies that push them forward.
Mm, yeah.
And I'd like to just touch on each of these because I think these are really interesting. Again, you know, that what I'm trying to do is explore the dynamics of Lennon and McCartney and just like talk about it within the Beatles world and start to get some of these conversations going so we're not just stuck in the way that it was told in 1971 and that has remained so since then, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay, so the meeting, you're saying that the conditions and characteristics that engender chemistry or electricity is this, and I'm quoting you here, this combo of usual similarities and unusual differences, which is what makes exciting and interesting. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because it's really fascinating.
Yeah, what I found over and over with Lennon McCartney, with Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, with Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy, with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, is this, you look at these two individuals who have chemistry and there are two things happening simultaneous. One is that they're so similar. It's really amazing that any two people would have so much in common. And at the same time, they're so radically different. Of course, anyone you meet, you could find similarities with and you could find some differences. But the simultaneous kind of extremes of those two conditions, that's what seems to predict people who are going to really spark each other. A deep, deep rapport, alignment, and a radical difference that, you know, creates a situation of challenge and sometimes vexation, and also, really gives sets up a situation where you can really learn a lot and grow a lot in that other person's presence.
Well, I think this is really important because, you know, in the Beatles narrative, there's constantly two different types of discussions that happen about Lennon and McCartney. They were so different. They were opposites. And then you get people like Linda McCartney who said that, you know, that John and Paul were more similar than different, you know? And so you hear that like, oh, they were very, very similar. They were, and Paul will say that actually, like, well, we were actually much more similar than you'd know. And we were just opposite sides of the same coin, you know, and then you get all these anecdotes about them being quite different. So it's interesting to know that this is a common thing, that both are true.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Both are true in extreme degrees.
Right. And I think, this is again, a quote from your book. You say that there's a similarity, a recognition. There is a recognition when they meet, like you've found a lost brother or sister or something like this. Yet, and the idea that there's a comfort in the similarity, but it's only one of the ingredients.
Yeah.
And then the other ingredient has to be that they're quite different, I guess, to add this dynamism or tension in the relationship, right?
Yeah. And for people who want to know how to cultivate creative exchange, you know, one of my suggestions is we are naturally drawn to people who we have kinship with. There's the social science term is homophily, that we like similarity. And so, you know, as a rule of thumb, you should actually be looking for the person who is going to challenge you. And emotionally, it's like, get ready for what that feels like, which might be excitement, but it actually might also be vexation. a lot of times, you know, two people who are going to do really, really meaningful things together really don't like each other when they first meet. There's a kind of implicit challenge. And if you go back to the church where Lennon and McCartney first had the, it's not the first moment they set eyes on each other, but the first moment they're really aware of each other. There was definitely a kind of an intensity and a kind of, you know, they may not have rated that a highly pleasurable moment, but it was definitely one full of energy, full of potential energy, certainly. I think that it aroused them to want to perform and want to outdo one another. You know, later in the book, I get into competition, and I think it's really baked in to that initial spark of chemistry. But then, you know, and this moves to the next stage. Chemistry does happen in a flash. There is love at first sight, but it doesn't build a partnership. You really need repeated experience. You need to log the hours. You need to develop trust. And trust only happens when you have repeated experience with someone. It really does require time. And I use the phrase, I use the term confluence to talk about, you know, how people who do have that chemistry actually go to identifying, you know, as a partnership. And it's another of a place where Lennon McCartney really illustrate this beautifully, because it really took, they logged a lot of hours, kind of core dynamic. And then there's a moment when they said, look, we're going to do this work together. We're going to share the credit. We're going to share the revenue. And that is a kind of formal moment for a lot of creative pairs. That's quite like marriage. You know, it's a kind of a legal, formal declaration of unity.
Yeah. I wonder if when they went to Paris, you know, John takes Paul to Paris for his 21st birthday. And that's, you know, after they're back in Liverpool, and then they go and they spend 2 weeks together.
Yeah.
And they seem to be very close. I sometimes wonder if that was the moment that they were committed.
Yeah, it was like, around then, certainly.
Yeah, like, but I just wonder if even that trip was meaningful, because John chose to take Paul with his birthday money and nobody else, you know, and so that was an experience for them,
yeah,
to explore all together, you know?
Yeah, probably so. I mean, the other thing that happens around that time is, you know, pairs do identify as a pair, and like to each other and to others around them, like make it clear, like, this is something special that you, that others can't be a part of.
Right.
And that very often you'll see an agreement that they make around what they do and don't disclose. You know, Neil Brennan, who is Dave Chappelle's partner, told me that when they got together and began writing Chappelle's Show, that they decided very early on that they weren't going to tell anyone who did what. And some version of that is really, really common. Paradoxically, that quality, which is so essential to partnership, is also what makes it so hard to actually understand partnership from the outside. And that has ended up being a kind of fuel for the lone genius theory, because people just don't know. They don't have the raw material to be able to tell the stories about what happened. It was definitely the case with Abernathy and King. People just, they literally didn't know what went on between the two of them when they were, you know, in their hotel rooms at night when they were, when they were in a jail cell. They didn't talk a lot about it to outsiders, and nor did Lennon McCartney. And, you know, until the time when they really began to put a lot on the record about who did what was when they were at their moment of greatest conflict. And so that body of material is really problematic as a source. Hang on one second. Okay. There's a dog barking over here.
Okay. Is that your dog?
It is my dog.
It's okay. Usually my dogs are like ever present in all of my podcasts.
They are, okay.
They're really old and they always make a lot of noises.
Okay. Well, we can roll on then.
Yeah. Dogs are welcome. One of the things that I wanted to say, though, is that, you know, I know that Lennon and McCartney, it took them a while, but I do think that original spark was there with them, because when you actually look at some of the accounts of it, of their original meeting in that first year or so together. A lot of it comes more from John's friends and the other members of the Quarrymen, but they say that like John dressed up, that he was very protective of Paul, that he cared that Paul was teaching him. You know, obviously Paul was very impressed with John too,
yeah.
But I don't want to undermine the love and connection that I believe that happened right from the start.
Yeah, it was profound. I mean, you know, I think if you could bottle what happened in that rec hall at the church, it is the absolute essence of chemistry.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I think is getting a little bit lost in the story is that their bond, like even Astrid, Stu's girlfriend, said that what John and Stu had was entirely different than what Paul and John had.
Yeah.
Which is important that it had this level of creative rivalry. Because I think that this idea of, you know, you talk about being seen by somebody that you think is your equal and, you know, that you trust and that you have faith in, and that you are competitive with, that is all baked into their relationship, which isn't easy. You know, Pete Shotton says that John was able to spend time with Ringo, but he was also easy for John.
Yeah. Yeah. They all were playing these essential roles. It was a big creative ecosystem, but definitely, you know, those two guys were at the heart of it. And there was, I think there was such a deep, it really, really worked, and it worked so well in part because of this conflict. And it was totally makes sense that conflict would boil over at a time of such instability after Brian Epstein died, and you know, when they were, you know, kind of moving onto a new phase of their lives, kind of, you know, moving from a period where they were naturally focused on their mates to a period where they would be more focused on, you know, their lives as in families. And it probably inevitable that there would be some kind of interruption, but I think you and I agree that it's, you know, the story of a breakup is way too simple a story. When you look at them in the 70s, you know, what I see are two people who had worked together so deeply and meaningfully and were really looking for the right circumstance to work together again. And it was planned to happen just before, Lennon was assassinated. In other words, they had a plan to get back and start working in it. And it just, that was the natural arc. I think that was, you know, on its way to becoming. But it's, you know, the story of a breakup just naturally kind of fits this, you know, rom-com, you know, narrative structure that we're so drawn to. And tuning yourself into creative relationship really requires you to get a lot more subtle. That said, if you really just naturally think about the people in your own life, and the relationships that you've observed directly, you know, that's the best way to tune into these things. It's not like it's some otherworldly phenomenon. The people who miss it are the magazine writers and the critics, but ordinary people, I think, have got great access to it just from their own experience.
Well, I think that's why there is such an interest and attraction to Lennon and McCartney, like the partnership, for all the fact that it isn't explored in books. And maybe that's because of the lone genius myth that, you know, people who tend to write books like to champion one or the other. I think that in general, you know, for example, the breakup series I'm working on is so attractive to people, you know, that they're so interested in it because it hasn't been done properly before. So I think that, you know, like you said, a lot of people intuit that there's more of a story there because that's how relationships work in general,
totally.
You know, very close to somebody. But let me just go into some of the interesting aspects of like these really dynamic creative partnerships. There's a few things that you talk about in terms of confluence and it requiring a few things, including presence, confidence, and trust, and ultimately faith. Can you just talk about those? Because I think that it's important to think about those in terms of Lennon and McCartney too.
I mean, showing up with presence, you know, logging the hours, like, you know, it's become a cliche that, you know, you have to log 10,000 hours to be great at anything. Yeah, there's definitely, in all the partnerships I saw, like, you know, that it's quite in contrast to this thing that you see as a trope in film where there's some kind of electric meeting and then it just flashes to two people like at their height. Actually a lot of mundane work just to be there, to learn the rhythms, to endure the frustration, and to kind of develop this form of communication that, you know, ends up feeling like maybe it's ESP, but it's actually just a highly like advanced, like knowing of the other person that is based on experience. Right. And that also allows two people to trust one another. I was just in a little spat with a very dear friend and they said, you know, can we come to trust one another? And I said, I think we can over time, but you know, trust is built on experience. Trust is not something you don't just decide to trust someone. You can take a leap of faith kind of into trust, but what you really trust is you trust that your home is going to be there to receive you at the end of the night. You know, when you walk through the door, like that it comes from kind of the repetition of experience. And then, you know, over time, trust like becomes something that is beyond that like concrete physical experience. And it does become something that, you know, the word faith best describes.
Well, I think all of this is so interesting. Like the idea of presence, of the idea of like really being sort of naked and present and yeah. Letting somebody see you. I think that's what Lennon and McCartney did, you know?
Totally.
So many people talk about being afraid of John, and it seems like Paul was never afraid of John, you know, like he was within weeks, he was like changing up the band, you know? So
yeah, he got right in there. Someone like John, who's, you know, has some bluster and a lot of charisma. Yeah, a lot of people would naturally just sort of fall back and look to defer. And I think that was part of the chemistry that McCartney really took it to him from the beginning.
And I suspect that was probably really important to John, is to be seen.
Yeah, totally.
You know, but to be seen by somebody he really respected.
Yeah. And so absolutely.
So this idea of presence I found really compelling in your book, that both John and Paul were really open. And, you know, Paul, he's got a wall around him too, probably because of the death of his mother, means that he wasn't sharing a whole lot of himself. So the idea that they really showed each other, you know, completely, or showed themselves completely to each other,
yeah,
I think is an important idea.
Yeah, I think so too.
And this idea of faith, and this idea that I had one special reader, and that was you. Like when they get to this level of partnership, it's like they only really care that there's one other person they trust, that they know, that they love, sees what they're doing. You know, at the end of the day, if you've got that, you're quite protected.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And I would think would have made them so much stronger in the world, that like, well, the person I value most, they like this song. So that would have helped.
Yeah, definitely.
And then you talk about the idea of the convergence in terms of the psychology of we, which I thought was really important too, because that's something that you see with Lennon and McCartney. You know, they talk about our songs and we did this. And there's this quote from John that I love from 66, where he talks about the fact that, well, only 100 people could probably understand our music. Like it was so internalized that their lyrics was coming from the two of them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's profound. And yeah, again, just totally iconic. Like that is what creative pairs do. And it sometimes sets them up for challenge later on, because there's a kind of dissolution of identity, certainly in the public mind. Like a lot of times, especially in the early days, people didn't know who did what. You know, legally there's joint ownership, and you know, it is quite like a couple, you know, creating a joint banking account. Like there's just there's a lot that you need a lot of trust to build up to that moment. But wow, once you've done that, and it's not just money, it's, you know, your whole creative soul being poured into these works that you share with another person. It's really profound. And, you know, I think it takes so much courage. The working title of the book was How to Explode. And the idea was, you know, that, yeah, it's like, this is a way to get big and kind of explode in that sense, like, you know, explode into success. But there is also kind of an explosion of the ego that is necessary. But I think which poses ongoing challenge, because we also have to take care of our own ego identity. I mean, that is part of having a healthy life, is to have a strong sense of self. For two guys who got together so young, you know, they were so formed in relation to one another. And so when the time came later for them to really clarify, well, who am I separate from this person? You know, that was naturally going to be a kind of messy process.
Yeah. You know, and they both addressed this in the early 70s, that they, you know, it's time for them to figure out who they are. And the fact that they bonded with women so closely speaks to their kind of almost inability to be completely on their own, or individuals on their own. John in particular, I think, really wanted to merge with somebody. Pete Shotton talks about this with John. He always wanted his name with somebody.
Yeah.
There's a story that Paul tells, which you talk about in your book, when they do acid together. Paul talks about them looking into each other's eyes all night and saying, I know. And this idea of, like, you kind of got lost in each other. Mm-hmm. And he seemed to both liked it and disliked it, mm-hmm. because he kept saying that he had to go back outside for his health. So I think for him, there may have been maybe more of a need for separation. I imagine John Lennon was fairly overwhelming.
Yeah, I think so.
But John actually talks about, this is one thing that we picked up on, is this idea of telepathy. Is that, you know, he talks about telepathy and the fact that they've got it. And I think he likes the fact that they've got this special, like he said, we don't like to talk. It's too slow. Music and talking through telepathy and music is much better. And I thought that was interesting, that was one of the themes that came out in your book, that's common for creative pairs.
Yeah, I think it feels like telepathy. There is a kind of physical, concrete explanation. I certainly could look at it in a mystical way. Social psychology really can do a lot to explain what happens. And I think that's helpful for people who, you know, who actually want to make work in their lives with other people and you want to try to understand that, yeah, this is a thing that can happen if you attend to the fundamentals.
Yeah. In the Get Back tapes, Paul talks about it. He said, you know, I know you want to have telepathy, but we don't have it. Like, I think at that point it was difficult because the whole Yoko and Klein and everything was messing with their communications. And so that, I think, was a huge problem for them at that point, that they were used to being able to communicate almost without words. But at that point, Paul didn't know anymore. And he says that out loud. You know, I know you want this, but we don't have it. So I think that's interesting. Also, something that's interesting to me is the idea of we, like this idea of this bondedness between them. It seems to break down around 1968. All of a sudden, John starts to be, instead of being willing to throw everything into Lennon McCartney, he seems to be much more protective about what his stuff is. And I don't necessarily think it's because he was bored. I think there's something that happened between them. There was some split that happened between them that made him defensive.
We all need relationship and we all need a sense of self. And I think that their bondedness and the way that they were identified together in the public mind was naturally overwhelming. And, you know, that again, this is, you and I agree that what's looked at as a breakup, you know, also could be seen as a really, you know, difficult but super healthy kind of move to get some space and distance. And this is another kind of core theme of great creative pairs, that they naturally find the right distance, the right kind of combination of proximity and kind of traditional intimacy, i.e. like you're in a room together, you're in a space together, and things that are traditionally thought of as distance, you know, being across town, being in other countries, doing other projects. You know, if you think about, you know, a couple experiences that you've had or couples that you admire, like what characterizes successful couples is like knowing what works for them. Are we going to be, you know, there are some couples who work together and eat together and exercise together, and that just that level of constant physical proximity works. There are also couples who, you know, one of them travels, you know, 6 months a year, and it just really suits them. And over the course of the Lennon-McCartney partnership, you see them, you know, working through these different phases, and it is an expression of creative intimacy all the way through. But part of creative intimacy is finding that distance. So when they got off the road in their intensive ways, and you know, one was living, you know, in the kind of Tony suburbs, and one was living in the center of London, like that was actually a moment of real creative explosion, because they got to kind of nurture their own idiosyncrasies, and they each had a lot of space to kind of do the thing that was going to feed them. You know, for Paul was really, really social in that time, was sucking up all kinds of influences in the avant-garde, the art scene in London. And John was also really going deep into his own mind and his own weirdness and his own, you know, exposure to pop culture through television. And it, you know, but then there was the coming together. There were the writing sessions, and that was a really, really potent moment. And it's a kind of waxing and waning. It's like, you think about it, it's not like, it's not a fixed position. It's more like a dance. If you imagine two people dancing, they come close, they move far apart. And it's the rhythm of that interplay that really, you know, makes the dance.
Right. This is a difficult one for me, because when I was, you know, I did see this as one of the important components, is some form of space and distance is important. And you can see that, especially for Paul, I think it was good to have that, you know, ability to be on his own in London. He seems to have been, many people have said he was the most independent of the Beatles in terms of just sort of carving out his own thing. But I think you're right in terms of like John being in the suburbs is always positioned as a bad thing, but it probably wasn't. He came up with incredible music at that time when he was going deep into LSD and spending time and reading. And those were all very creatively fertile things.
Yeah.
But here's something that we've noticed. John mentions a number of times that their partnership fell apart when they weren't living together. He says this like a number of times in the 70s that, well, it ended when we stopped living together. And then, you know, when I look at it, they stopped touring together in 66. But then, you know, then there apparently John was at Paul's place all the time in 1967 when they're writing Pepper. You know, he practically lives there. And then John spearheads them all moving to Greece to live together. And then they do Magical Mystery Tour together. And then they go to India together. And again, John mentions that, you know, the end, he could see the end when Paul and Ringo left India. I think that maybe, like you're saying, that the creative distance was quite good for them. But I wonder if it triggered John's anxiety and abandonment issues when he didn't have his family, like his little Beatles family close to him.
Yeah, maybe so.
I suspect that's an issue with him, because there's just, you see him really trying to get them together and to live together in some form. Like that was the John dream, was going to the Greek islands. And then he proposed a town in England, and then he proposed an island in Ireland. Like he really wanted them to all be in a community, you know, but it's unfortunate that they weren't able to see that actually this is good for us to have just a little bit of space, because the stuff that they did when they got back together was fantastic.
And you
talk about the ability to keep surprising each other too, which I think that, you know, that this distance enabled them to do as well, right?
Totally. And I think, you know, Lennon was an extreme character. He was extreme in his wish for, you know, immersion with others. And he was also extreme in his need, you know, for differentiation. And that's a paradox that's hard to wrap your mind around. But all great characters are paradoxical.
Yeah.
You know, that's a reason why, you know, biographers who tend to be very unilateral thinkers are often inadequate to the task of really grappling with great creative people, because it's just shot through with paradox.
Right. One can feel sorry for Paul when you think of, you know, I see John as hugely needy, but also in multiple ways. Like, I don't know how anybody would be able to actually meet all of those needs. And then he seems to be so hurt when people don't, you know?
Totally. You know, go back to his upbringing. It's you know, it's easy to see how some of those dynamics emerge, and to have a lot of tenderness for him and a lot of appreciation for all that he did. That was, you know, that was constructive and creative. There was so much hurt and so much need.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, John is so sweet in some ways and then so difficult in others, you know, but again, that's what makes him fascinating. Fascinating. You talk about the infinite game, the nexus of competition and cooperation.
Yeah. The infinite game is not my phrase. I borrow it from a very influential book of the same title. And the argument of the book is that there are finite games and infinite games, and that finite games are defined by rules and boundedness in time. And the whole point is to declare a clear winner. You know, sports are finite games, but that the real passion and wonder of life comes from what this author calls an infinite game. And the whole thing about an infinite game is that there are two people, they're kind of at each other and playing at each other and often competing with each other, but the rules are shifting, it's not bounded, and the whole point of it is to keep playing.
Yes. See, that, I think that is so wonderful, because that is what I feel like the one thing that Lennon and McCartney could not stand is for one of them to stop playing. Like, that's what I think that they always needed, is to know that their person was going to respond and was still engaged.
Yeah, and they did keep playing, and it's totally crucial to understanding the relationship they had to know that when they were ostensibly broken up, they continued to play with one another, but from a distance. They continued to try to challenge the other, to try to respond to the other. You know, they were digging at each other and their lyrics. Like, that itself is a kind of relationship. The opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. And they were never indifferent to one another.
But that's unfortunately where the story went. You know, I think in John's desire to rewrite the story, to elevate the Lennon-Ono partnership, you know, he told the story that he was creatively bored in 68. And, you know, that's kind of, he probably didn't even tell that exact story, but that's how it's been spun, that he had lost interest in the Beatles and the Lennon-McCartney partnership. And that always disappointed me. It was like, oh, this thing that seemed so amazing just died. And I don't even know why it died. And then, you know, now that I've obviously spent years digging into it, it's like, man, that never died. In fact, that it even remained intense until John died. And as you say in the book, that it continues to live on with Paul, you know?
Yeah, but it's also just natural for things to wax and wane, and to, you know, have moments of boredom are also just part of the creative journey. We get bored with our own work. We get bored with our partners. You just need to take the really long view to understand things. I mean, you can't take that 1,000 feet in the air view, like when you're in the midst of living your life, or when you're commenting, you know, from any fixed vantage point. I don't know. I think obviously the gold evidence when you're studying a creative person is what they said and thought, but you also have to understand, like, when are they saying it? What's the context in which they're saying it?
Right.
It does.
Right. What's their agenda?
What's the agenda? You know, what's the hurt? What's the need? What's the wound? What's the perspective?
Yeah. Well, I think the wound is a good one too, actually, because, you know, especially with John, Paul's more measured in terms of his responses, although I do think he responds sometimes from a wounded place, but certainly John does, you know, and certainly he did in the breakup period where unfortunately he said some things that are taken as like gospel now, even though he rejected them later on.
Yeah. Well, he was fiery and tempestuous, and, you know, he contradicted himself sometimes in the same sentence. And that's also really characteristic of a creative mind to be able to, you know, what F. Scott Fitzgerald said is that, you know, the test of a first great mind is the ability to hold two opposing concepts without cracking up.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what we look to art and great rhetoric and, you know, architecture, that we look for opposites to be melded, in part because it's so hard for, you know, for us to do that in ordinary life. We have to, you know, choose one or the other, often one or the other extreme.
Right. And somebody who knew Paul well said that he had that ability too. So, you know, that's
characteristic of all great creative minds. One of the most influential books for me was, you know, by the psychologist Csikszentmihalyi, who created the idea of flow, and he wrote a book about the flow of creativity. He studied highly adept, highly productive, creative people and extremely accomplished people. And his primary finding is that great creative minds are characterized by a series of being able to occupy both sides of kind of a series of contradictions, of contradictory positions. So for instance, really, really creative people are able to be highly attuned to what other people think of them and also like deeply indifferent. They're able to kind of move to like, this is what I think, and, you know, middle finger to all of you, to like, no, I actually really need to take a lot of input now. And their ability to occupy those extremes, that actually is what defines a creative person. And I think that's certainly true of Lennon, McCartney, and became of each of them. You know, their characters are really complex because there's so much duality in each one of them. And then when it comes together, it's like, oh my God, there's so much complexity to manage.
Right.
But, you know, again, it's something, if people just look into their own heart and their own experience, I think they can identify with it. So much of discovering the truth is just putting down the biography and just like paying attention to what you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, the problem is, I think that people have to let go of a lot of the ideas that we've got in our heads now. That's the problem, you know, with Lennon and McCartney, is there's things when I was looking at the breakup that I had to say a million times to myself, to like, because I kept reading things with what I had understood to be the story that really wasn't, you know?
Yeah.
So one of the things that you say in your book, or you talk about, that I found really interesting, is the overlap between eroticism and creativity, or more, maybe it's the eroticism that is part of creativity, or in creativity, there is an eroticism. Anyways, this combination of these two things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, eros is associated with sexuality and with sexual function. But it's so much more. It's so much more in human life to be aroused, to be heightened in a way that affects yourself, you know, your physical body. And there's so many forms of love and attachment. And, you know, I think we reduce that to, you know, only one kind of experience, and we make kind of the sex act like the center of all intimate and erotic experience, and that's definitely not the case. That quality of, you know, in its primal sense of eros is really fundamental and exciting and also, you know, destabilizing, like to really be drawn to someone, you know, in a physical way. It's like, oh my God, what do I do with this? And a lot of times, you know, people who are you know, really governed by fear. Like the first thing you do when you have that experience is to turn away. And I think what you saw with Lennon McCartney is that they certainly, you know, for a very long time, they kept turning toward it. And they kept, you know, they stayed in the fray. And, you know, so much great work resulted.
Yeah. You know, that's one of the things that we posited is that there is so much gray area. Like, this is the problem again with talking about them is that, you know, we used a couple of other musicians that were songwriters that were talking about the fact that when he's writing with his partner, that there is an element of romanticism, of eroticism that is, you know, that is coming from the creative process, but it gets confusing because you're so into it. And then you finish it and then you separate again. But it's just like, we're talking about people that are having an experience that is quite hard to understand for, I think, the everyday person that's not involved in that. But we do have all elements of that in our life. You spoke with Esther Perel, who I've actually written to because I would love to talk to her about Lennon McCartney, because I think it's really interesting to talk to therapists about creative partnerships. But you said that you asked Esther Perel, who'd written and lectured widely on eroticism, whether sharp distinctions could be drawn between physical and creative desire. She smiled and said, of course not.
Yeah. I remember, you know, talking to one of the partnerships that I spent a lot of time with, they're not extremely well known. I didn't end up actually naming them in the book, but they were a married couple, and they still are a married couple, and they worked a lot together writing television. And the husband of this couple said that he was never more aroused than when he saw his wife, you know, really doing her best work. And that actually resonates with Esther has asked people all over the world when they're most aroused by their romantic partner. And it's the same answer when they see them kind of at a distance or nearby, kind of embodying their kind of highest potential. That's the strongest moment of arousal. And I think there's a real interplay. You know, I ended up using the phrase creative intimacy to describe what I was interested in the book. And, you know, I think we need a whole vocabulary to translate terms that are mostly associated with friendship and with romance to creative production. Cause it's so fundamental to creativity. I think our language is really pretty emaciated because so much of the language is formed by this lone genius fixation.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so sad that we're just so immature and just reflects such impoverished thinking that like the only thing that matters is like romantic love. It's like, yeah, romantic love is really, really meaningful, but like the realm of erotic and intimate experience is so vast.
Yes.
And even within a romantic couple, you know, I think if you were to really think broadly and expansively and creatively about what Eros is and can be, that would enrich romance much, much more than looking at everything through the lens of romance.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really silly position, but listen, there's very little attention to the intensity, the depth, the range, the importance of creative relationships. So, you know, where is this stuff going to get talked about? It doesn't get talked about in, corporate, you know, consultant language. which is totally, you know, their whole thing is to eliminate relationships from the systems of, you know, of production, because it all, you know, they don't want to have to talk about emotions, and they don't want to have to talk about, you know, they're trying to create these kind of uniform systems that relationships really disrupt. In 2020, if what you can do can be reduced to a set of rules, then it can be done by a computer, and you're on your way to obsolescence. The things that can't be reduced to a set of rules are these deeply human experiences, and the core to human life is the way we manage the movement between solitude and relationship. And so the idea that being professional is to kind of excise these emotions is just, it's so counterproductive. And the first people to tell you that would be the people who are performing at the top of any field. The first person to tell you about the importance of relationships in finance would be Warren Buffett, you know, or, you know, Steve Jobs, as weird and power hungry as he was, like his genius was in identifying the partners. And he did this sequentially through his life, you know, with whom he could, you know, make insanely great things. And yeah, it's, you know, there's heartbreak and there's excitement and there's, you know, it's going to be super, super emotional. And that the culture of denying that is unfortunately that is the dominant culture, but it's just totally wrongheaded.
Well, you know what? And we see this in, this is my personal struggle in talking about Lennon McCartney. There is such a division between the old school, we call them jean jackets, who are like the 1970s, like, you know, Rolling Stone writers that are still around and talking about the Beatles. And they're very fixed. You know, they've bought into the fact that Paul and John were never friends. And then you've got this other crowd that see them as a romantic couple. But I think it's because, and then there's very little middle, we're trying to operate in this middle ground, saying they had a really important deep relationship that was really important to their creativity. And it's worth talking about. But both sides, I mean, you know, it's really difficult because of that.
Well, it makes what you're doing all the more important.
Yeah. Well, I do think it is, because, like, you know what? Their relationship was really important.
Yeah, it's like, it, even having to deny it, though, kind of puts you in this, like, really, I think, problematic frame. It's like, does the thing that matters most, like, whether they, was there sexual contact at some point? If there was, it was, you know, compared to the thousands of hours they logged on stage in the studio, exchanging ideas, and that quite manifestly, you know, produce this body of work that is so fundamental to who we are as a civilization. I mean, let's just focus on
exactly
what, it's like you walk into a room, if you're, you know, are you going to, like, if you're an architecture critic and you walk into a room, or like, are you going to be obsessing about, like, you know, the wiring that's like in the earth? Are you going to just look at what's right in front of you? Look at the light, look at the materials, look at the shapes.
But that's exactly right. And thank you for saying that, because that's what we concluded. It's like, I don't know, maybe there was something between them, but that's really, like, that's not the issue. The issue was there was a love and a chemistry underneath. That's the important part of the relationship. I think if there ever was anything physical, it was secondary, you know, just, it's not the issue. So, you know, and I don't personally know anything about it, so I'm just going to exclude that.
You don't know. I don't know. Probably no one will ever know. And, you know, getting some humility about, you know, about what we can know and can't know is a really important starting place.
Yeah.
And just getting comfortable with that, and appreciating that's part of, you know, that's part of the grandeur of life.
There was a quote, I don't know if you've ever seen it, from John in 1972. He was talking to Sandra Chevy in an interview, and he says, and I'm paraphrasing, he says that maybe if my partner and I could have had a relationship, that would have satisfied it. He doesn't mention Paul. He mentions between him and his partner.
That's interesting. I forget exactly what the data is, but there was a median age in England at the time for marriage. I think it's 26 or 27 or something. And if you know these guys are young teenagers when they met, and they're in their late teens and early 20s when they explode, and it's just a natural time in life to be mostly oriented around your buddies.
Yep.
And John had a girlfriend and she got pregnant and they got married, but that was never the primary driving, you know, relationship in his life. Was it was clearly with Paul and the band. Mm-hmm. And they were moving into another phase of their life as they got into their mid and late 20s. And it's really natural, and it is always disruptive for intense creative pairs when other people, when the context around them begins to shift. So that's how I read, that's the association I have to that quote, that yeah, it's like that there was a lot of instability bound up in the other characters. And Paul got together with Linda, if you trace, and as I do in the book, and really, you really like drill down, like when did they meet, and then what happened, and then what happened, and then what happened. It really helps you understand the kind of the instability and the disruption and the competition and this you know period that they moved in that eventually led to what is you know erroneously considered a breakup, but they were going to have to go through it. You know, if you take the big picture, they actually did. They did go through it, and they did get through it, and they were moving to a place where they were ready to work again. You know, you look at Crosby and, you know, David Crosby and Graham Nash, who, you know, have had the great fortune of, you know, a long life, and neither one of them died tragically young. And there are many decades of waxing and waning and, you know, touring together and doing solo work. And, you know, the chemistry and the sense of bondedness has remained. And, you know, I think if you had to predict, if there hadn't been a tragic ending of the life of one of these two, you know, wondrous partners, that's the life that they were set up for and that they both, you know, they both really clearly wanted. So that's yes. the real, you know, that's the real breakup is, you know, comes with the assassination. And even then though, when you're close with someone, when someone has so decisively affected you and influenced you, the relationship carries on in your mind. And I think that's definitely true for Paul as he relates to John imaginatively.
Yep. Yeah, that's really interesting. That's how I see take John's comment too. You know, again, there's people in the fandom that run with it, but it's like, to me, he's just saying, I think he's saying that because he says that, you know, maybe if we could have been a couple that would satisfy things, but we're not, he says, we're not homosexual. That's what he says.
Well, right. I mean, I'm sorry to cut you off, but the other thing is that if you, I'm not fixated on sexual preference, and I think it would be a huge mistake to do it. But obviously, it is a factor a big factor in the way we're oriented. If you look closely at John Lennon and the way that he used language and the way that he talked about what turned him on, and it. This is not an unambiguously heterosexual man. I don't want to label him, but there's definitely a big, thick fascinating picture, and it would take, you know, a great literary writer with a lot of skills to really try to tell a story about his deepest erotic life. But it's, you know, I can say for sure that it was really complex.
Yeah. And you know what? It really comes out in the early 70s. Like, this is something that we noticed when we looked at his interviews from the early 70s. He's very confused. He talks about, well, you know, we were just four fags in a band. And
oh, yeah. I missed that. That's really interesting.
You know, what does he say? That it's more convenient, or it's.
Right.
Once he reconciled that it was a woman, you know, it's just like, right. John, what are you talking about? And why did nobody pick up on how weird this all is?
Yeah. And, you know? And what, you know, what kind of life might he have had led it if he had not grown up in such a repressive. He was a voracious, curious, you know, he really defied form. So just it makes sense. Yeah. He would defy conventional sexual type.
Right. And so that this idea that to that comment that he made, I sort of thought the problem was other people coming between them and jealousies and possessiveness and all those things that they would have had to have dealt with, like you said, at that period when they're in some ways splitting and having to find a new equilibrium when they have other partners. Because as you said, even though John was married and Paul was with Jane, I think that their commitment to each other was still stronger.
Yeah.
Then when Linda comes on the scene, and Paul seems to have had a strong attraction, like there was something between them right from the start.
Yeah.
Which I think,
yeah, that's really evident, and you can follow it beat by beat, and then what happened when they went back to England, and you know what happened with, you know, I read the, you know, the romances of those period as a call and response. It's not to say that was happening between John and Yoko was incidental, or between Paul and Linda, but they were definitely like, they were super, what was happening in their romantic sexual lives, you know, with these new partners was super involved with each other. And
it definitely was.
But yeah, I mean, it's all part of this great drama that we, you know, need to take in as a tableau. It's like, again, just to think about, you know, complex and wonderful. Just think about, like, if anybody were to think about, like, the last, like, really good, like, HBO drama that they loved, like, yep. And then you try to apply the questions that, like, you know, are typically applied to like historical characters. It's like, it's silly. It's like the pleasure is in the subtlety and the nuance and the complexity and the way it kind of defies like these really rigid categories.
Right.
And every moment is related to every other moment. And
absolutely.
There's misunderstanding and there's, you know, contradiction. And that's the way that life works.
Yeah. And I like your idea of, like, that's what we were trying to do with the breakup series, was actually look at what came before this action, because that's how people do act. They're reacting to different things in their lives constantly, you know?
Yeah.
And the idea of it, looking at it as a tableau. I mean, John knew Yoko for a long time, but until Paul really connects with Linda, he doesn't really seal the deal with Yoko.
Right.
And then once John gets together with Yoko, Paul dumps the girlfriend, or, you know, sets up a breakup with the girlfriend that he's probably not meant to be with, for the one that he has the stronger relationship with. And then there's issues between both of them. And then they get married within 8 days of each other. I mean, it's insane. Lewis was asked.
And it's so mundane in a sense. It's like, yeah, of course that's what these guys are going to do. And of course they're like, you know, they're super fixated on the other, and it's all, well, it's, and it's, you know, you go, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, It's so true, though. We even looked at the language of, like, the day that John announced he wanted a divorce. Is all they could remember. They're both talking about the color of each other's face. And it's like, oh, my God, they're so fixated on each other. They don't even remember who else was in the room, you know?
Yeah.
And so don't tell me that these guys didn't care about each other. But people like Lewison, he was asked, like, do you think that their weddings had anything to do with each other? And he said, well, no, John Lennon never commented on it. And it's like, well, of course he didn't comment on it. But can we just look at the behaviors?
Yeah. Yeah. I just think it's super, super counterintuitive.
So you don't really believe that the breakup that they went through in 1969-70 was a true breakup? You know, we've talked about it.
I mean,
how would you characterize it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I had to reckon with what happens at the end for partnerships, like I decided to use this word interruption, and that's the word I would use. There was an interruption. It was a really, you know, ended up being a really significant one, but it was so significant in the end because of factors that were outside of the kind of mutual interest of Lennon and McCartney. First, there was an incredibly complex legal problem that they had about the corporation and the ownership and all this stuff. And the lawyers were deep in the weeds for years. And so that really compounded things in the late 60s and early 70s. John's relationship to Yoko, who certainly was and still is a huge force, also really compounded things into the 70s. And then, of course, John's death, you know, when he had roused from a period of dormancy, introspection, you know, maybe depression, maybe intense addiction in the mid and late 70s into, you know, back into a period of creative production. And he made it really clear, like, he was coming back to life, back to recording. And that part of that project was to work with Paul and the band. And if the question is, like, did they still feel a deep sense of attachment to one another? The answer is definitely yes. And was there a huge, like, interest in the other and a sense of the other as, like, a really kind of key creative force in their lives? The answer is definitely yes. Was there competition? Was there anger? You know, was there even some bitterness? Yeah, that's also part of human relationship. So no, I wouldn't use the term breakup. I think it's really shoddy storytelling. I think people use it because they like to just put a period at the end of that sentence and move on. But I think it's so much more interesting when you open yourself up to the question of, like, well, what was really going on and what followed and what was the arc that they traveled on? But unfortunately, it also makes the story much, much sadder. It's like, if you could persuade yourself that, yeah, they broke up in 69 and of course they were never going to work together again, then, you know, knowing that in the, you know, 50 years that have passed, there are no more Beatles music for the world, it's, I think, easier to digest if you just think, oh yeah, it's, you know, they broke up, it was over, the dream was over. If you really open yourself up to what actually happened, it makes that loss, like, much more palpable.
Well, yes and no. Like, and to your point, like, so I started this breakup series and I'm continuing to work on it because you realize that they never broke up. But, you know, you said, this is a quote from your book that you say, the reason we can't assign a date to when John and Paul definitively split is that it never definitively happened.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm finding is that, you know, I keep setting, like, well, this is probably when I can end the story, but you can't. Because, like, by the time that things settled down in 1972, they start to re-spark again. And, you know, 73, 74, they're back to connecting. And so it is the infinite game with them. And you know what? Ultimately, I find that story less sad, even though there's more tragedy to that because they wanted to get back together and they were moving that way and we were robbed of it. They were robbed of it. That is very tragic. But the fact that their creative spark never died, I think, is a much nicer story for me anyways. You know, to think that, I think it's the truth, but it's also a better story. I like to think that that energy remained.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, you're emphasizing the bright side, which I'm glad for. And there is so much warmth and life in this. And, you know, that one of the simple but profound pleasures all through this process was just really listening deeply to the music, putting on good headphones, and just really being with it and feeling how much is there and being, you know, it's,
yeah.
I was born in 1971. So when I grew up with this catalog, you know, which had been completed when I was born, but it's also, you know, what it's there for new discovery all the time, and you know, that spark that was at the core of it is it is a spark toward life, toward, you know, I mean, creativity is the, you know, it's the discovery of what it is to be alive. These two guys really, really embodied it and articulate it. And I think, you know, show us something way beyond, you know, their own experience. I think they show us a possibility that is, that we can all have access to, you know, in our own way.
Well, that's very beautiful. That's a lovely way to end. You know, and the interesting thing is that, you know, if you look at their lyrics, and I mean, we're reading into things, but there's certain things like in John's songs, he drops Paul's, you know, song titles, lyrics, the word wings. I think there are shoutouts throughout constantly, you know, throughout the 70s between the two of them. Just there is a continued dialogue that almost has been ignored. And, you know, people, I guess, if that makes them feel better, then fine, whatever. They don't have to see it. But I love the fact that there is, like you said, there is this interplay that continued between them, this creative spark that,
yeah,
like you said,
totally
resulted in all of us.
Even in the most bitter moment, like, how can you sleep? Like, there's a lot of delight, you know, I think, and a lot of, and if you think about who in your world are you able to really be openly angry at?
Yeah.
It's the people that you're closest to.
Oh, yeah.
A child can't be openly angry, you know, if a child is openly angry at their parent, like, that means something really, there's a really healthy culture. And I think that it's, you know, to say that anger or even bitterness is like to kind of narrate that as a detail of disenchantment. It's like when you're really disenchanted with someone, when you're really letting someone go, you stop thinking about them. You stop referring to them. You stop, when you're like, when you're writing a song that like comes from this like deeply energetically angry place, like you're still in the thick of it.
It's true. That's what I don't get. Like, that's why I'm always confused. Like, why didn't these journalists get it? You don't write a song with that much emotion, which people always say, like, that was the sexiest song on the album. It's like, yeah, because that one had all the emotion. Why they just thought that meant he didn't like him. Like, yeah, he was angry with him. But to your point, I mean, the scary thing would be if he just didn't care.
Yeah.
Which is probably why Paul was able to shrug it off. You know, it's like, well, at least he's still thinking about me.
Well, shrug it off and take it as fuel for his own rejoinders. I mean, he was involved in the same project. He was like, okay, well, so now we're in a phase where we're going to assemble different kinds of bands and different studios, and we're gonna trade lines in a different way. They traded Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane, and now they're gonna trade songs in a you know, in a different context. And he was, I think, you know, I'm sure there was all manner of feeling, but he was also like clearly, you know, involved in his own creative project and, you know, and did a lot of great stuff. I mean, I love John's solo stuff. I love Paul's solo stuff too. I think they really articulated, you know, in a really beautiful way, kind of, you know, their hearts and their, and, you know, I think, I don't know, that's, I think it's a trope in one, in what's the Ethan Hawke movie, that follows a boy across his whole childhood and the moment when this father gives a son, he says, this is the great last Beatles album is like all the best solo stuff. And if you think about it, if you think about George's stuff and John's stuff and Paul's stuff, like all really speaking to each other. And it is another manifestation of, you know, of the band in a way.
Oh yeah. I mean, actually Paul has said that John told him that Jealous Guy was written about him too.
Is that right?
So yeah, in 1985, it's interesting because he said that to Playgirl magazine. He said, John told me that he had written the song Jealous Guy about me. And it doesn't get traction. Like there are certain stories that people don't want to know.
Yeah. That's so beautiful though. That's one of my favorite songs. It's also been covered so beautifully.
Yes.
It's so tender and open and loving and introspective. And yeah, that's I love hearing that.
How important is that to the story, though? But this is what drives me crazy, though, is to me that's really important to the Lennon-McCartney story that, yes, John wrote How Do You Sleep About Him, but he also wrote, you know, Jealous Guy about him and told him. You know, so that's what Paul knows. Paul knows both sides, that I deal with John and this is when he's angry. And then I get this other John who writes beautiful songs to me, too. You know, so that's part of their experience. And it bugs me that our culture only likes angry John at Paul, and it frustrates me.
Well, listen, you're doing important work in response, trying to hold a more capacious, you know, human vision, you know, two really big and wonderful and complex human people, you know, and it's important. I being part of it.
Thanks, Joshua. Take care. I appreciate it. Everyone, this is Diana. If you are enjoying listening to this podcast, please leave a review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It will really help other people find the podcast. And I love reading reviews, mostly if they are good. So please leave a good review. Also, you can follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, all under the name One Sweet Dream Podcast. And you can email us at onesweetdreampodcast@gmail.com. Thanks. Look forward to hearing from you. Take care. Bye. You and me chasing paper, getting nowhere on our way back home. We're on our way home. We're on our way home. We're going.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.